Welcome. We'll try to do a conversation between John Baldessari and myself on the occasion of his exhibition, Pure Beauty, that opened yesterday at MACBA. It is an exhibition that has been curated by Leslie Jones from Los Angeles County Museum of Art and Jessica Morgan from Tate Modern, institutions to which I'm thankful for the collaboration into this project. And this exhibition will further be on view at Los Angeles County Museum and the Metropolitan Museum in New York. John Baldessari is, in my opinion, one of the most important artists that have changed as well and have produced or activated what we call contemporary art, and has also a history of a relationship with this museum, also with myself. This is an image of an exhibition, a project that John and I produced in 1998 at Witte de Witte in Rotterdam, and then traveled to Barcelona to the MACBA at that time. It is a show. In its original configuration, it was called Four Rooms with View, Plants, Lamps. And it was together with a project that was curated as well by Michael Schamberg, including numerous video works by different artists in a very international scope and also chronological scope. This exhibition consisted, or this project consisted, on a wallpaper, which we see different configurations and photographs of lamps and plants. In the original idea was to evoke the rooms of a home in order to show these video programs. Now, this wallpaper, we don't see it, maybe we don't completely see it in detail, but each wallpaper featured two motifs, which are interesting also in relation to what we see in the exhibition here at MACBA today. The greenish paper that we see on the left has noses and popcorn. The bluish on the right features pizzas and clocks. And okay, here you see better. And then there was, what is it? There were, in the pinkish area, there were pretzels and ear. Ear, you call it?
Ear.
Yeah. Ear. Mm-hmm. And there was a fourth one that we should see.
I think a light bulb and a potato.
Exactly, a light bulb and a potato, which, it was, somehow we're missing that one. Oh, but that was the blue. Okay, that's 12 years ago, that's 1998, but it brought John's work in a sort of ambience and recreation of the intervention I wouldn't say in a sculptural way, but in a ambience way.
Well, I think for me what was interesting that I became almost an interior decorator. I want to back up a little bit. Gossinet wanted me to do an exhibition or offered me to do one at Witte de Witte, and I just had too many exhibitions. And he very wisely said, well, how about collaborating with an artist that we're planning to show with? I kind of like that idea. I don't know whether the other artists would have liked the idea. That worried me a bit. There were two. I finally narrowed it down to one, an old student and very good artist, Rita McBride, who had done stadium seating as sculpture, which I mm-hmm. you're going to acquire here, which is a beautiful work of art. And I thought, well, that's possible. And then this other project, a friend of mine who's not, doesn't advertise himself as an artist, which I like that, Michael Schamberg. He has his feet in two worlds, the music world and the art world. I first met him. He was getting posters done for New Order and asked me if I would do one, and I finally did two posters, I think. Anyway, he put together this collection of artist video called Video for the Home, and I sort of liked that idea. So what I did then was create wallpaper, and then once I did the wallpaper, I thought, well, if you have wallpaper, then you have to have something on the wallpaper. So I made these giant photographics in black and white, because they were so colorful. I said that'd be a nice kind of collision. Very simple home things, like a potted plant and a lamp. And if you, what I had in mind there, you can find these things in normal homes, but also in terms of morphology, if you turn a lamp upside down, it looks like a plant, and if you turn a plant upside down, it looks like a lamp. So there was always one facing the other in each room. Mm-hmm.
And there was a nice story also you mentioned at the time with related to Rudy Fuchs about a lamp, right?
Yes, right, yeah. Rudy Fuchs, the former director of the Aesthetic Museum in Amsterdam, an old friend of mine, I did one of my first shows in Europe in Eindhoven. We had gone to Marfa, Texas, where Don Judd has his foundation, where I had a show. And have you ever seen pictures of Marfa? It's desolate. And then you come upon this incredible situation of seeing Don Judd with deer in the background and tumbleweed and then these very precise stainless steel boxes. It's quite surreal, but anyway, it's not much around there. So we arrived and we went to the supermarket to buy food because they were kind of apartment living situations where you could make your own food. So I came out with, you know, probably a bottle of vodka and some popcorn, you know, the basics of living. And Rudy had a little lamp under his arm, and I said, "Really, why did you buy that?" And he said, "Well, I have to read, don't I?" And I thought, "Wow, that's amazing! You know, here's this intellectual and middle of a wasteland, and he was buying a lamp with which to read." And that just stuck in my mind, you know, just as a kind of a 20th century image of enlightenment. So I think that informed this work. So you're always getting a collision, you know, like about being an intelligent person and being a couch potato. So they, but anyway.
No, maybe we have other images to accompany us through our talk that maybe could be projected now. They are random images from works by John that will remind us. This exhibition is the largest to date of your work, and to me, it makes me discover work from the early years that I've seen in reproductions, but that, for instance, the text paintings always nearly reproduce in kind of black and white, while we discover now that they have very concrete colors as a background.
I call them landlord colors, the kind of you have in a bad apartment.
And again, of course, your work has been associated with the origins and developments of conceptual art, but we see in the second room of the exhibition that language gives the space for a number of works that deal with landscape and deal with the search for geometrical relationships within that landscape. What was the role of geometry, or what did you try to use geometry for in relationship to landscape?
Well, I have sometimes said that I call myself a closet formalist, that I don't advertise it, but I'm very concerned just abstractly how the work looks. And this was even before Photoshop. Now it's very easy to go back and manipulate a photograph. But even back then, in a black and white photo, if let's say I would go back and rubbing oil paint into the blacks to make them even blacker, or changing an area with white and so on, very concerned how they look formally. They can be seen on both levels, you know, just as pure form or about content.
Mm-hmm. Some works as well, in those early years, we're talking about the passage from the 60s to the 70s, some of these works also use photography as a documentation of certain actions. Was performance an important, or the action in itself an important material for you in those years?
I think only in terms of video. I guess those could be performances that where there's no immediate audience, but an mm-hmm. audience down the mm-hmm. way.
One of the elements that I also discovered after many years of looking at publications and seeing also the work in some shows is how much in the way you use the iconography from cinema, the work becomes, it's full of emotions. It's full of fear, of violence, of attraction, and it is obviously a very tense work.
Yes. Well, I do quite often use images from the movies. I have to confess that was not the original idea. What I was really interested in those early years was what we now call appropriation, that is, using already pre-existing images that one finds in the world. And why did I do that? Because I guess I thought there were enough images around where I really didn't have to make new ones. For instance, if for some reason I wanted an image of a house, I'm sure there are plenty of images of houses around. I didn't have to make a new one. If I wanted to signify house. So anyway, you get the idea. So, and another reason too, I wanted to escape my own good taste. So, you know, if I went out and photographed a house, I think, you know, it would be a beautiful photograph of a house. And I didn't want, because as I said, I wanted to escape my own good taste. And so then you get to the question like, well, why would you want to do that? I had this idea that, it's not even an idea. I think it's patently true that the more an artist works, each time you do some work, you get better at being beautiful. And then I just wanted to escape that. I thought it as a trap. I didn't want to be beautiful because I thought that was what happened anyway. I didn't have to work at it. So I was really kind of working against myself. So anyway, one of the devices I used was using found photographs. A friend of mine alerted me to a place in Los Angeles that sold photographs from movies. What they call production stills. There's somebody, you know, they're taking photographs of the movie being made. Went out to take a look, quite expensive, because usually they're about a particular movie or about a particular movie star. They're something like $10 at a time, and even then that was a lot of money. But they said, well, you know, if you might be interested in this. And they had these giant bins of images that they couldn't classify, you know. I guess the category of what we call now a straight to video. You know, that interested me a lot, because I really wasn't interested in movie stars or a particular movie. I was just interested in images. And quite luckily, too, they were mixed in with a lot of photographs from local newspapers. And that was kind of interesting, because images for newspapers are staged like movies, but they're using, you know, characters in the city rather than characters that are actors. But when you start thinking about it, it's pretty much all the same. So I began buying these just because whatever interest I might have in them. You know, I got them for 10 cents each. And I now have huge, you know, files of them. At first, I tried to categorize them. I noticed that immediately they found into two big categories. So one's about violence, and one's about love. I said, well, that's the basic setup for movies, isn't it? Then I think I start using those, I guess, in the early 70s. And then I realized that, wait a minute, these images, people that see movie, they're carrying them around in their minds. You know, we talk about movies all the time. Do you remember this scene? Do you remember that? Remember this? And so I said, well, then I can kind of manipulate the images that are in people's head by making new movies out of those movies. And so it's kind of fiction 3 degrees or more removed.
And how do you work physically, all these works? I mean, there are photographs, but there is color sometimes, and there is...
Well, way back there, I mean, the most primitive way possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I would actually... I'm sorry I've done this now, because I've destroyed so many good photographs. I would just cut them up, you know, like Kurt Schroeder's. Then I got a little smarter, and I bought a Xerox machine, and I make copies, and I would paste those up and make layouts for the work, and then I wouldn't touch the original photograph. Mm-hmm. And then you get Xerox machines that would enlarge or reduce. Mm-hmm. That helped a lot. Now with Photoshop, everything's so easy.
Sure. But also, how much did influence the development of the photo development techniques? I mean, from a certain moment, your work becomes bigger and bigger.
Oh.
In size.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I had a dark room in my studio, and I, as a younger person, I was quite interested in photography, developing my own film, making my own prints, and I learned a lot about art making from photography. At any rate, back then, The largest print you could make would be 20 by 24 inches, and you would have to, you would have to have trays that size. You could, you know, build your own trays, of course, but you couldn't buy the paper that big. I discovered in Los Angeles a business that made billboards photographically, one of a kind, and they could print imagery, I think, up to, at the time, pretty wide, 6 foot.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, you would have to tile it or, you know, join them. It became a little bit of a problem because for advertising, they don't care about quality so much. You know, you're not going to be close up to it with your nose to it. You're going to be some distance back. Mm-hmm. But luckily, somebody working there was kind of a part-time artist, and he understood my problem and would reprint things. You don't make money so much reprinting things, but, you know, he was quite good about it. And then word of mouth, I would tell artist friends and so on. Before long, about half of their business was doing photographs for artists rather than for advertising. And now, of course, we are in an era of we call dry photography, no longer that kind of processing.
Of course. And I have the understanding that you have been also one of the first artists to use a video and in a creative way, from the beginning of the availability of this technique.
Yes.
How would you describe your use of
okay.
video?
There's a very important art institution in the U.S. called California Institute of the Arts, or summarily called CalArts, and that started in 1970, and that was the whole idea was to approach, let's say, the arts in a fresher way than normally that it had been regarded. So we got all of the interesting students in the U.S. Headed there for at least for that year. It was an incredible group of students, and we had incredible faculty. We had a lot of the artists from Fluxus teaching there, like Nam June Paik and Alan Caprow and on and on. And Nam June started a video department, and he had great connections with Sony. At that point in time, the first portable TV setup camera was introduced, called the Sony Porter Pack. Via Nam June's connection in Korea, we had 26 of them for students to use, which is incredible. I don't think any other school even had them. So I availed myself of them, and as did many other artists around the world. And in that period, you begin to see a lot of artist video. I think that was about the first time. One could not edit. To edit, you would have to go into a professional studio. So we have what a lot of that period we call real-time video. It occurs without editing. And many of those videos are simply the length of the videotape. So the half-inch videotape came in 30-minute reels and 60-minute reels. And if you look at any catalog, most of the videos are 30 minutes and 60 minutes, which is kind of funny. Quite often, that the subject of the video was the artist herself or himself. And one of the early video artists, Bill Wegman, said you can always tell a video from that time because at the end of the video, the artist gets up where he's sitting and gets up and shuts off the video camera. And it's true. And they're all really boring. I think with my videos, and some of them are here, I took advantage of that idea of being boring, and I tried to be even more boring. And that's what you're going to see.
Speaking of videos, it makes me also think that an important part of your work also has taken the form of books, which in a way is also media, some kind of form to exist within and outside of the gallery space.
Yes. Yes, that was another. Not that artist books had not been done by the early 60s, or when we're all this conceptual minimal art started. But a book or a print, an edition, for me is like having cheap art for people. I remember the first book I did. I think it was in the late 60s. Trying to get it printed, I had several offers to make it very expensive. like maybe $500 or $700 a copy. And I thought, you know, I don't want to do that. That defeats the purpose. I want it cheap enough that students can buy it. And finally found a publisher that where they could be sold for about, I think, about $10 a copy. And I said, well, that's, you know, that's pretty good. Students can do that, and I can give them away and so on. So the unfortunate consequence of all of this, of course, that these early artist books now have become quite rare. So that book that was sold for $10 now, you can probably get it on the internet for like $300 or $400, which is kind of defeats the purpose. But at any rate, artist books are great because anybody can buy them. I think artist prints, you can get them very cheaply. And so anybody can buy art, you know, very cheaply.
Yes. You have mentioned before CalArts, and we should be aware that John Baldessari has been teaching for many years in important schools of art, CalArts and UCLA, among others. I read a book time ago, which was called Jack Goldstein and the CalArts Mafia. Tell us something about precisely your ideas of teaching education with art. Can art be taught? Can people learn to be an artist?
Well, you know, I can write a few books about this, but I'll try to make it brief. I came to CalArts, and the prior job was the University of California in San Diego. The big difference, of course, was that at CalArts, we're trying to be a really radical school. We didn't have any curriculum. We didn't have any grades. Students didn't have to go to classes. And a student might start in at a first-year level, and we might decide, well, they don't have to hang around here for 4 years. They're good enough to leave next year. At any rate, that kind of idea. So essentially, grades were not there as a punishment. If a student wanted to come to your class, they came. If they didn't, they didn't come. And so we did lose a few instructors because the students just didn't come. The good part about that, it forced the artist teaching there to be somehow useful, somehow meaningful to the students. Or else, why would they go to class? They didn't need a grade to get to graduate. So I think that taught me to be very inventive. My first principle I use, and I still abide now, is that I believe that art can't be taught. And so everything kind of followed from that. But, you know, there's an addendum, but an ambience can be set up where art might occur. And I think for that to occur, that you have a very nourishing atmosphere. And for that nourishing atmosphere to occur, you need real artists, not teachers, but artists. And if they're real artists, they'll find a way to make contact. And as in addition to that, I also treated them not as students, but I considered them as young artists. And I would say, listen, if you were my age now, you might be a much better artist than me. The only advantage I have on you is that I'm older, and I might help you get to where you want to go quicker. That is, if they're reinventing the wheel, and they don't know they're reinventing the wheel, I might point that out to them. And I've solved many problems they were in art making that they were about to try to solve, and I could help them along that path. Basically, that was it. Oh, yeah, and then I think another thing, a lot of, I would work with them on their work, they would work with me on my work, and so a lot of that early work, it was kind of collaborative in some way, and some of the pieces in the show here, you'll see, as young artists, some very now famous artists, so my ideas, I think, were okay.
Yes, you mentioned Rita McBride, of whom we also are preparing an exhibition for 2012, was a student of yours in Los Angeles, but other artists like Christopher Williams or Matt Mulliken, we've seen work
Jack Goldstein,
collection.
Jack Goldstein. You want me to talk about that?
Oh, yes, please.
Sorry.
That is important because he's also an artist in the collection of the museum.
Oh, okay.
And it makes a lot of sense.
Jack was one of my students, and I've always said that with art, you can't become an artist just as a matter of will. You have to really be talented and obsessed, it has to be a situation where you can't do anything else. Well, Jack certainly was that. I remember once, and back then he wore these sunglasses that were mirrored, so you could never look into his eyes. So that made him very cool. He never smiled. If he smiled, it was like, what did we say, it'll break your face, kind of like Clint Eastwood. And I said once, Jack, I'll bet if you had to, you would cut off your arm to do art. And he just said, yeah, I would. And I believed him. He was obsessed. At any rate, he had some pretty powerful fellow students. an art historian that was teaching there at the time wrote this book. And I think the term the Cali Arts Mafia was something I think that the New York art world used, because it was the New York art of that time was like a fortress. They wouldn't let any European artist in. They wouldn't let any other artist in. You're New York or nothing. And slowly, Cal Art students began to come, because I would urge them. I said, there's nothing here for you in Los Angeles. Go to New York. That's the next fight. So they would slowly move into New York and then slowly begin to appear in exhibitions. And then this name came up, the Cal Arts Mafia. Oh, more of the Cal Arts Mafia. And Jack was one of them. But he always kind of felt left out from his peers. And I think the reason was that they were very smart. All these things they learned about conceptual art, what we call now the dematerialization of the object and blah, 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 blah. The artists that went there that were successful began to make paintings, make objects. David Sally, Ross Beckner, Eric Fischel, on and on and on. And it worked. Jack stuck to his guns, kept on doing video films, performances. And then one day he just decided that, he had to make paintings to survive, and he started making paintings. And I don't. Do you have a painting here?
No. We have records.
Records,
and
yeah.
Films.
Yeah.
And films.
Yeah. Yeah. See, and you don't sell records and films. You give them to friends. And so it's really, the book is a series of interviews of his peers, collectors, museum people, critics, talking to Jack and what Jack has to say to them. And he was a very bitter person and unfortunately committed suicide.
Yes, very tragic. And yeah. In order to go back a little bit to the exhibition and to your work, I mentioned the strong presence of emotions in this work of the 80s that related to cinema. And then when we go towards the 90s, the language reappears in your work. We've seen the Goya series, for instance, another combined with imagery, with iconography, and then in the later on, objects begin to appear. You prefer to call them objects than sculpture, but they're somehow three-dimensional. How do you connect this?
I think for me, sculpture has always been a scary word ever since I was a student. I was lousy at doing sculpture, and so I just always avoided it. And I guess at a certain point, I began to, I get bored easily. I think that's what it is. And so first of all, when you look at a photograph, if you're very clinical about it, all photographs look alike because they all have the same surface, the same reflectivity. Okay, that's a tough one. I mean, you can either accept that, okay, they all look alike, so what? But I decided to then to begin painting on them so I would change the reflectivity. And then I got bored with that, just having a single planar two-dimensional surface. And I thought, well, what if I have a level above that surface plane and maybe a level below it, so the work would exist on three planes. So I guess at that term place you would get something we would call low relief sculpture. And then I think you can chart my flirtation with sculpture, and there where ending up here in this giant cloud brain, which is pretty much a thing. You can't say it's a painting or it's two-dimensional. I guess the final frontier would be if I finally did something that was existed in the round, 360 degrees. I haven't done that yet.
But precisely most of your work from that period of the 80s and part of the 90s insists in breaking the orthogonality of the photograph or of the painting or of the work. I mean, there are no more 90-degree angles.
Well, that too. That started way back when I started deciding to use photography. All of a sudden, I realized how dictatorial photography was. You have a viewfinder that has a precise height-width relationship, probably golden rectangle proportions, I suppose. Or in a reflex camera, it's square height-width. And so right away, I began trying to change that. I would draw. I had a Rolleiflex, and I would drop in new masks like a triangle or a circle or a long rectangle, just so I could get away from how people, the manufacturers, thought I should shoot a photograph. And even way back when I taught painting, I said, listen, paintings don't have to be rectangles or square. If you have a painting, don't try to necessarily make it fit the square or rectangle. Cut it out. It can be. Just cut out the stuff you don't like and keep the stuff you do like. So it started way back.
And precisely in relation to that use of forms, I have described or I have mentioned some of these works, characterized some of these works as collages. We know that they're not collage, but what would be your, how would you explain your relationship to some of the early 20th century avant-garde inventions like precisely photomontage or photocollage?
I don't mind that, but when you think about it, probably since Picasso onwards, paintings have never been a fixed point of view. You bring in something from here, something from here, and you're composing it on the canvas. So that's a kind of visual collage, even though it's not, cutting it up. I think what I prefer that I do a kind of hybrid, that is, colloquially you say neither fish nor fowl, that you can't say my works are a photograph, you can't say they're a painting, and now you can't say they're a sculpture, but they're a combination of all of those elements. It's been a problem for me over the years because a museum wants to buy something, and you're split up into departments like the Museum of Modern Art. They say, well, they'll say it's not painting, and the photography department says it's not photography, and then there I am out in the cold. But I prefer that. A very firm part of my personality, I hate categories, I hate baskets, I hate classifications, because those are just man-made. They change all the time in science, we'll see it, and they don't change too often in art for some reason.